This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moisoso. Hey, guys.
Hello, everyone. This week, we had a bad planning decision on my part. I thought, oh, Jason talked about vampires last week. Let's talk about vampires again this week.
And yeah, could have been a repeat with swamps and thing that lives in swamps.
Yeah, that was kind of the feel I was going for. I don't know if we hit the mark. So
we'll see.
We'll see.
Again, I do broad strokes.
Yep, and you go details. Yes, yep. That's why we are who. That's why this works one way or the other. So, let's see. It could be very good. It could be very bad. It could be just a mediocre episode. I'm okay with any of those.
Mediocrity.
Yes, but what it definitely will be is a new episode of Not Alone Podcast where we talk about vampires
again. So
At least it's that. And then I've decided that I guess I've been spending a lot too much time trying to be reputable, and I just want to go back to telling some spooky stories. So I'm going to just try to find some spooky, not like creepypasta where it's like obviously fake, but I don't know. Maybe I don't have to like buy a book on vampiric folklore in order to make an episode. Maybe I can just be like, oh, this is creepy.
Nah, dude, you just need 20 tabs open in Safari. Right? I'm not that wrong, am I?
Where is my Safari? Do I still have... Oh, no, I closed that window.
Oh.
That being said, I hope you enjoy this episode. I do. It was not bad. You know, it wasn't bad researching. It was pretty interesting, pretty good to me. So we'll just see where we get. And if halfway through we feel like we're just wasting everyone's time, we'll just shut down. It'll be good. So this could go for the full length. It could go for half the length. Who knows?
So we could even make this an hour-long program.
Yes.
Oh,
half
man.
The length.
Yikes. Look at us. Well, Sam, Go ahead and lead us in. What are we talking about today?
Whereas your special last week was on blood and the blood's relation to the vampire in general, right?
Yes,
this,
the blood.
This, for me, is more of where, for the common man, where did the vampire come from and where did he go? So the tale of the vampire, the vampire, it was brought over from the old world. The vampire comes from these nightmares that haunted our ancestors in Europe. Like we said last week, Jason discussed some of the more common origins of belief in vampires among old world emigrants that found their way into America. Things like the Countess Bathory, Count Dracula, they stand tall amongst the rest of the major cultural contributors to the vampire mythos. But it can be agreed that they're atrocities don't fit within the kind of proto-vampire. They're very good for the fleshed out, the royal,
aristocratic
that we think of vampires now. But back in the day, the vampire wasn't that way from the beginning.
Right. It wasn't like romanticized.
Exactly. What we see is that in the 19th century, the vampire was stalking through New England in America. And in the United States, the vampire that affected these people, although, of course, we really pride ourselves on not having peasants in America. No one's a peasant in America. But essentially, we're still poor farmers. And the same poor farmers that were peasants in the old world are not peasants in the New World, but they suffer from these same sorts of vampiric afflictions.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we go really far back, most of the New England colonies were just trying to find gold like the Spanish ones did.
Yeah.
They didn't find gold. Instead, they found furs.
Yeah.
And the fur trade was the biggest income producer. Otherwise, pretty much everyone else was relying on agriculture.
Exactly. And those agricultural...
Which they did really poorly in the beginning.
Yeah. Those agricultural folks, while, you know, Bram Stoker was inspired by Vlad the Impaler, the inspiration for these humble working people of the 19th century wasn't literature, especially because it hadn't been written yet, Dracula, all of that, but it was these tales that they brought with them from the old world. Now, vampires in general are found, like, the idea of something stealing the life force. Energy. Yeah, yeah, the life force is found everywhere. I mean, it's
a global phenomenon.
It's ubiquitous. However, the word vampire itself was never... or it was not officially documented. It wasn't used in any official capacity until about 1725. And it's one of the most well-known cases of old world vampirism. It's that of Peter... Here we go, everybody. Peter Blagojevac. Blagojevac. We're going to do that. Peter Blagojevac, who lived and died in the village of Kisalova in Serbia. Serbia
is the homeland.
it is ground zero. It's not Transylvania. I don't even really know, other than Dracula, obviously. But, like,
it's funny because Dracula never actually lived in Transylvania.
Right.
It just sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And it has a cool fake castle there.
Yeah. It's very strange that everyone thinks of vampires in Transylvania when in reality there's absolutely nothing from Transylvania other than the Romani people who play a role in a lot of Dracula, or not Dracula, vampire stories like this one that we're going to talk about. So you have Peter. He's in Siberia, or Serbia, not Siberia. Different
thing. Very cold.
Yes. Ground zero for vampirism. Serbia at the time in 1725, essentially it had been ruled very much by the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, mm-hmm. and then it was transferred for a period of 30 to 40 years to the Austrian Empire and taken back to the Turks. These stories come from that period in the Austrian Empire because the Austrians, I'm not going to say they cared about the Serbians, but they cared about at least documenting the Serbians in a way that the Ottomans really didn't. They went into the villages, they listened to the people in the villages, they wrote it down, they published it, and they put it around the world. And that's why these stories, it's 1725, but it is the first vampire story ever published, because before this, it was all just folk belief and no one cared what the peasants had to say.
Mm-hmm. And this one was publicized to the point where it spread across all of Europe,
yes.
Correct?
Yes, all throughout Europe.
This was the first, like, official vampire.
Mm-hmm. So Peter Blagojevac, he was buried in 1725 after passing due to some sort of an unspecified illness or event.
Which happens frequently.
Yes. It's actually the default setting
unknown illness or event. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's only recently that we in the first world countries have experienced life without constant death from disease.
Mm-hmm. I was looking, and even as late as 1950 or so, mm-hmm. like, the life expectancy was still like 42 years old.
Yeah.
And so it's only really past that we've seen it creep up to, I think it's like 79 mm-hmm. years old is the average, which is good, I guess. Kind of freaks me out a little bit. That's only like 55 more years.
Yeah, man. I'm about to hit my quarter life crisis.
I did hit that this last year. That's like why I made this podcast and why I'm making a movie or trying to make a short film is because of that quarter life crisis. So he dies.
Yep.
Within 8 days of his burial, 9 other individuals are dead. They died suspiciously quickly with no prior indication of disease. Now, the other thing that's very, very interesting about this is what the diseased and dying had to say on their deathbeds. And according to the records, every single one of them said it. They complained of feeling drained as though the life force had been sucked out of them. And they told their loved ones that they had been visited in the night by Peter Blagojevac, and that he had throttled them. And that this throttling is what started their sudden descent into ruin. They said there was even a claim by Peter's wife, his widow, who said that days after the burial, somebody knocked on the door saying that he was Peter and he wanted his shoes. He needed his shoes. And it was dark and it was night and she couldn't really see him, but it sure sounded like Peter. And so she got his shoes and she gave them to him. And she said, you know, if you're Peter, come in. You're my husband. Let's, like, I don't know, be together. And he was like, no. And then he just walked off into the night. So, and then you have another story because unfortunately, one of the people who died, one of these nine victims of Peter, was his son, actually, his boy, who it was said that he said that his father had come to him requesting food after his burial, and he gave it to him the first time, and then he left and went away, and then he came back, and the second time, he says, no, father, like, come be back to life. If you're alive, come be alive. And he was like, absolutely not, and throttled his son and started him on his decline.
Darn vampires and the throttling.
They really throttle. That's like really a thing that they do, which is so interesting. It's in the Serbian. So as opposed to the more modern day idea of vampires coming up and biting your neck and sucking your blood that way, in these Serbian tales, it was just throttling. It was just taking your hands and squeezing someone's throat really, really hard. Now, the truth of this situation, quote unquote truth of this situation, as it came out, the villagers became, rightfully so, very, very terrified. And they go to essentially the representative of the Austrian government. He's kind of a religious and governmental figure all in one. Mm-hmm. And they say, we need to do something about this. We need to get rid of this vampire the ways we know how. And he says, well, let's talk with my superiors and we'll see what they want to say. One very, very interesting thing that comes out of this is the response. And the response is absolutely not. We're not going to wait for that because in Turkish times before the Serbian areas were ceded to the Austrian government, in Turkish times, this happened and it wiped out entire villages. They blamed entire villages on these vampires being wiped out. And they said, basically, if you don't let us just go do this, we're leaving. Like, everyone in the village is out of here. And that's it. And he says, okay, all right, okay, well, all right, fine. And so the villagers, led by the local priest and accompanied by he's called the Camaral Provisor, they all go to the graveyard. And of course, they dig up the grave. And in horror, they find that Peter's body has an appearance of life in it still. His cheeks are ruddy. He has color in him. They say that his nails have fallen away and new ones have grown. Same thing with his skin. It's tearing, and you can see new, beautiful skin underneath. And, of course, most shockingly is blood all over his mouth. And that pretty much seals the deal for them. So they pound a stake into his heart, and when they do, blood starts gushing from his chest. And with that, they say, okay, he's definitely a vampire now. If he wasn't a vampire before, he's definitely a vampire now. They take his body, they burn him, and then they put the ashes back in there. Case closed, vampire done. Interestingly enough, unlike with later stories that we'll see, this did seem to, at least within its own self-contained story, stopped the spread of disease. Like, there were no other reported deaths after this. So we had been talking last week about how you really only need it to work once.
Yeah.
And if it works once in folklore,
then it's a bulletproof word.
Yeah, that's the way of doing it. And it's very possible and most likely probable. Granted, of course, it would have been done before this as well. But this would have been the one time in maybe the European general consciousness that it did work.
At least fairly recently.
At least,
you know,
fairly
one
recently.
That's publicized.
Yes.
And something that we could actually get a firm account of, even though, I mean, we're still talking like 300 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the first story of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, for me, one of the more interesting things is this idea that in the Turkish times, which could have been any time before 1459, or between 1459 and 1718, was this idea of just whole communities being obliterated by quote unquote the monster.
Right. I mean, like if so during this time period as well, vampires were your typical go-to boogeyman for right. kids as well for storytelling and things like that. So it's already kind of perceived in the popular subconscious that these things truly exist.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have that level of belief, even if the ruling classes of a different, you know, culture, different religion, it can still have a profound impact to the point where it requires to have very extreme solutions.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we'll see later on, it would be wrong of us to think that even in the 1700s, that the people reading these stories believed in what was happening, believed in the idea of the vampire. It's especially wrong to think that that's how it was in New England, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But the gentry pretty much consistently has always said, this is ridiculous. This is just peasants being peasants again and just being
yeah,
foolish.
Vampires seem to be more popular in
rural areas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ever since the start of it, it's been something for the poor and the uneducated, apparently, or supposedly.
Yeah, and also for a lot of times, folks in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably the most important bit of vampire history, simply because it expands it to the Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when we start getting the Gothic literature about 100 years later about vampires and their new twist on them.
Yeah.
And then that cements the vampire to what we know today.
To where we are now. So the story of Peter, Blagojevic.
Yeah, Peter B.
Peter B, Petey B. That's the first known published vampire story. It was followed hot on its heels by another one that actually I would say caused more of a panic in regards to the vampire in the 18th century, especially when it comes to Serbia and Austrian control and all that.
Yeah, sounds like an obvious way of escalation.
Mm-hmm. Because the story of Peter B, PDB, he has, what do they have? They have the priest, but the priest is also rural. He's from that area. They have the villagers, and then you have the one individual, the government official in the city or in the village. And granted, he did say that he saw this and that it happened and he thought it was a vampire or something, but you only have one quote-unquote reliable witness.
Yeah, it's almost like it happened in a different world.
Yes.
You know, it's not something that we can relate to as easily as, of course, people from that part of the world.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just like this, oh, that happened in that one place and it doesn't happen here.
Yeah. However, there was another story that broke again out of Syria in 1726.
Serbia.
Yes. What did I say? Syria. I've called it Siberia. I've called it Syria. It's Serbia.
What other S named countries do we have? That's and S start with an S, end with an A. I think
we're good.
I don't know, but you're gonna find out one it is next.
Yes, it is.
We're gonna call it the Sahara next.
The Sahara. Now, not in any small part, this story of Arnold Biole. I could be completely wrong on that. Arnold, as we'll call him, it caused even more of a panic, even more fear, even if it was only passing, because of the documentation, because of the players involved. So what we see is Arnold. He is a Serbian infantryman. And essentially the way that it was is that these little militiamen would go from town to town to town and they would keep the peace. And they worked for the Serbian homeland, but they also worked for the Austrian government. And in this point in time, he was in the Serbian village of Medegnja. Cool. Now, he was a bit of an odd duck in the area. He had moved to the village, like we said, as his role as a militiaman. And he was well known in the village for his stories. One of them that he told very, very often was about how he had been hounded. And this is where you really get this idea that made it into Dracula, of how the vampire sets its sight on someone and then just pursues them, mm-hmm. like he does with Jonathan Harker and Lucy and all of that, or Dracula does, just pursues them and pursues them and pursues them. And a lot of times it takes a very, very long time. But he says that a vampire had been hounding him in this village called Gasowa, and he had rid himself of the vampire's spirit by eating the dirt of the vampire's grave and covering himself in the vampire's blood.
Yeah.
Yeah. So right off the bat, these are two things that culturally are not all right. Like, the eating the dirt is weird, but whatever. But covering yourself in the blood of a vampire is one of the ways that you become a vampire. So right from the start, he was not very well received.
Well, I mean, then again, that also just shows the differences in folklore from village to village. Mm-hmm. Like, it is, so that's the thing with the vampires, is that it is just so incredibly different and unique, depending on what part of Europe you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have, one thing led to a completely opposite reaction in a different part of Serbia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it could just be misinformation for the region that he's currently in.
Yeah, just, you maybe know, he thought, oh, they're going to think this is badass, but in reality, they're like, oh my God, you're a vampire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, as he tells these stories, as he lives in the area, he lives there for a time. We don't know how long exactly, but what we do know is that his life ended when he broke his neck in this area falling from a hay wagon.
That would do it.
Yeah.
From a hay wagon?
A hay wagon.
What is that, like 3 feet at best?
You know, a lot of dying comes down to the angles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I, as a child, fell like 15 feet and landed directly on the very top of my head.
Perfectly fine.
Onto a rock. Yeah, and I survived, and it's only because I was pretty much straight. If I could have very easily cracked my neck and been dead. But I'm not, so here we are now. It all comes down to these angles. So
yeah,
just
the geometry,
remember,
of life.
The geometry of life and death. That's like a great album name, I feel like. So just remember, if you're falling just really 90 degrees, 90-degree angles, you're probably going to be okay. So please don't sue us if that ends up hurting you in the long run. Anyway, he falls from a hay wagon.
We're going to have a disclaimer at the end of this episode.
Yep. Now, within 30 days of his death, so we already have a little bit of a difference. Originally, Peter was in the ground for 9 days. That's just not a lot of time anyway. With this one here with Arnold, it's about 30 days until people really start dying around him. Four other villagers complained very similarly that Arnold was visiting them, menacing them, throttling them, until one by one they also passed away. As before, the villagers took matters into their own hand, exhuming the corpse. And this time, as opposed to just a mouth covered in blood, it was said to be leaking out of all of his orifices, his eyes, his ears, his nose, his mouth. And even after 40 days, the body looked very much alive, as if it was simply sleeping. So you have this detail.
Which all of that is very, very in line with natural decomposition.
It's just how decomposition works.
Yeah.
But, and of course, we have to keep in mind that this went through journalism. This got spiced up here and there.
And I mean, he could still look that good, mainly because of the season that he was buried. If this was the winter or late fall, he's probably just cold.
Right.
You know, and that helps preserve quite a bit.
The other big detail, there's two or three big details that really makes Arnold stand out in the vampire world. The other big detail is that it was said that he was lightly breathing. It seemed as though his chest was moving, which is not a normal part of decomposition, to the point where I'm not saying he's a vampire.
Just the gases in the body.
It could be, or it could just be the people being like, oh, he was definitely breathing.
Yeah, he was
breathing. So, and then the same thing with his eyes. His eyes apparently, as he slept, were moving as if they were in REM sleep. And then finally, okay, so they see this and they're like, well, that guy's a vampire. Let's do it. Let's get this going. And they take the stake and they hit it. And they're not necessarily, I think you may have said this last week, they're not aiming for the heart. Did you say that, or was that in something I watched?
Probably something you watched. It depends on region.
It's hard to say. Well, they just in general, right nowadays, we think you've got to stake them right in the heart. They're not aiming for the heart. They're just aiming to pin him down.
I'm pretty sure that was a Stoker thing.
Yeah.
Was specifically the heart.
Yeah. So they're just trying to pin him down. Yep. As they do, it's said that his eyes open and he screams, blood-curdling screams, and starts thrashing and thrashing. And finally, they hold him down, and finally, he just bleeds out. Like, just in general, there is a lot of blood, which, again, normal in decomposition. The screaming, the wailing, not as much. But
actually, the screaming and wailing actually usually are.
Really?
Yeah, it's actually just the gases leaving their body, creating the sounds. So, and that's usually like the dead ringer for a lot of people thinking that it is a vampire, because once you stake them, they scream out and they bleed and everything still, which is literally just the pressure that has been built up by decomposition escaping the body now that has a way to do so.
Totally fair. Totally fair. Flailing of the arms. What do you say? Is that one normal decomposition?
I'm going to probably chalk that one up to dramatizing it a little bit more.
Serbian folk beliefs. Yeah. I don't believe that these people were vampires. I just want to make that straight.
I really wish they were, but yeah.
So he is. He's flailing all of this. I believe with this one, let me see. Yeah, so they burn the body as well. They reduce it to ashes. They throw the ashes back into the grave. So the other big important thing beyond this original component of a vampire hounding someone that Arnold gives us is this idea that anyone affected by a vampire becomes a vampire. So the four people who died because of Arnold Pale's nocturnal escapades, they dug them up and they burnt them as well, just to be safe.
Yeah, and at that point in time, they were just going through a huge vampire panic. And like I mentioned last week, the Austrian or Hungarian empress had to send out her personal physician to literally debunk all of these. And then she made it eventually illegal to do grave tampering because of how widespread this had become. Yeah.
This is it. These are those stories.
Yeah, this is the vampire panic. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, unlike Peter, however, who was an open and shut case of vampirism, Arnold.
Yeah, that one tied itself up real nice.
Yeah, it was nice.
Bow
it was nice.
Perfect.
Yeah. Arnold Pale, he left some lingering tendrils of his vampiric power. So
please don't call it that.
Right? beyond feeding on people, he was also said to have fed on cattle in the village and therefore spread his vampirism to the cattle, which would have spread it back into any human who consumed the cattle. Therefore, 5 years later, in 1732, when 17 people died within a period of 3 months, all of them complaining of nighttime throttling by other dead people in the village.
Did you ever see The Little Vampire?
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. Vampire
adorable.
Cows.
I know, right?
Vampire cows, dude.
13 members of the village, because of this, these people who were dying, they traced it all the way back, 5 years, back to Arnold. And it ends with 13 members of the village from an 8-day-old baby to a 60-year-old woman were dug up, heads were removed, and bodies were burned.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond the cattle, remembered after the attack started, it was said that some of the dead had painted themselves with vampire blood, so they believed that in the Turkish Empire there were vampires everywhere. So if you ever went into Ottoman territory, you had to take necessary precautions, and like Bale had said, coating yourself in vampire blood works pretty well. It's a taboo and a faux pas in Serbian areas, but it's going to work in Turkish areas because of the differences. So they cover themselves in vampire blood, or they've eaten other animals that have been feasted upon by vampires as well. And these activities, along with Pale's lingering forces, culminate in this mass just unburial or exhumation and mass burning, essentially.
Yeah, it sounds like the Serbians just needed more garlic in their diet.
Could be, yes. That very well could be it. The report itself was made in 1732. This Austrian report was made in 1732. It was signed by six different military and medical officers of the Austrian Empire. And this one is truly where we get more of the lore. So Peter was the start. You get two or three really unique pieces of lore that come from this specific area and make it through. So much of it, like you said, were invented by Stoker. The transforming into a bat, that's Stoker.
Yeah, purely the bat. Otherwise, previously in Mediterranean cultures and in Eastern European, it could transform mostly into everyday livestock.
Yeah.
That was the big one. Dogs, cats, cows,
wolves.
Sometimes wolves, yeah. But typically, it could just shapeshift into what you see around you on a day-to-day period, mm-hmm. not necessarily a bat. The bat was, again, a stoker.
Stoker. The heart stoker. The hypnotism stoker. So, right, the vampire in modern days is very hypnotic. Eyes and all of this, and right. that stoker silver can't be seen in mirrors. That stoker.
Yep.
What you have
crucifix
stoker. We're gonna talk a little bit more about the crucifix in general, but
it's stoker.
What we come down to though is the base idea that comes from Serbia, specifically Serbia, through Europe to the New World, which is the dead feast on the living. That's what it comes down to, and really when I look at it in that light. I know I kind of disagreed with you last week. I don't completely agree with you still, but I do see how having elevated the vampire to an aristocratic noble race.
Yeah, how we
it creates a void for a lower being like a zombie. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah we romanticized it into something that is more of a primal version of ourselves, which is I think why we get so much of a kick out of it now.
Yeah.
And yeah, that kind of left a void to be filled by a different creation.
I agree. In my own way.
And it's still, like when you think about it, vampires are just zombies. But instead of eating brains, it's drinking blood.
Yeah.
Like that's literally the only difference. They're both diseases a lot of times. Like everything currently with zombies is a disease-based
right.
for the most part. Nothing is done with voodoo anymore. That was only in the very, very beginnings. And it's transformed into, again, like the subversion of a vampire.
Mm-hmm. Fair.
Maybe it's a subclass of vampire.
It could be.
Oh,
well,
my
and
gosh.
That's why you like look at I Am Legend, film which has been remade 50 times. I Am Legend is not about zombies. It is a vampire book. It was written about vampires and this and that, but the vampires are zombies, and the zombies are vampires.
Yeah, they're...
The further back you go...
It's tough to tell the difference between them.
Yeah, it's harder to distinctify between the two, for sure. It is essentially the same thing. It's just the methods and the operation. The zombie is a machine that works... It is a mindless machine
that works towards its own
individuality. Yes. Whereas, which is again
and
from
it is
the,
more instinctual, yeah.
Which is from the Haitian lore and the Haitian practice is that it kills the ego completely and leaves you as a husk. Whereas the vampire,
it's almost like the epitome of the ego.
Yes, yeah.
It's the exact opposite.
Even back here in the first earliest times, you still get people not saying that it was a monster or anything like that, but saying that it was specifically Arnold and specifically Peter, and that they did this to preserve the self, whereas the zombie did it to preserve only the body. So, yes, very interesting. Maybe one day Jason will write a paper on it. That'd be dope. Write a book about it.
Paper?
Yeah.
Write
a paper.
I don't even read, Sam. I'll make a YouTube video.
Make
about
a YouTube. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that. Okay. All right. Anyway, okay. This next section is titled, I'm very, very proud of this. This next section is titled New England, New Vampires. So the very first case of
vampires.
Well, that's true. Also,
because nothing really has changed with vampirism in New England.
Well, but they're new vampires. They're different vampires. Okay.
Uh-huh.
There's also one last vampire from the old world. His name's Sava Ardek or something like that. He lived in a watermill.
Ooh.
He was pretty cool. And then, so he lived in this watermill. People knew exactly where the watermill was.
And did they not burn it down?
No, they didn't. And like people would say that millers would go in and that they'd get killed and thrown out. So people stopped going to the mill. It collapsed in like 2011. And just as a little ha-ha joke, they put out like a public warning saying like, hey, Sava can now look for a new home. So be on the lookout. But
that's pretty funny.
Yeah, he's the most famous, theoretically, Serbian vampire, but he's also the most mythological. Whereas the other two individuals are definitely rooted in
fact. We have historical evidence of their existence previously.
Exactly.
Before we hop the pond as well.
Yes.
Still, vampire culture is... fairly prominent. I saw something, I think it was the early 2000s, of a case of vampirism in Romania where the villagers did exhume the body, cut out the heart, burn it, and then mix the ash with water, and the relatives drank it, and then they were healed. So it's not something that has, you know...
No, it hasn't.
It hasn't left. Yeah, it hasn't. It's only not in the 1700s, but it still is a very popular piece of culture in that part of the world today.
Yes, yes. Now, the very first case of vampirism in the New World is hard to stake down. But
so bad.
I know, it was bad. Researchers,
you should have said pin down, because that would have been a little less punny.
I wanted to, the pun was completely intended. Yeah, I wanted it to it be that have bad. Been,
okay. All right. There you go.
Yep.
That's what I wanted to hear from
yeah,
you.
Yeah, totally. Wanted it was to be terrible. So the very first case of vampirism in the New World is hard to stake down. However, vampires, no, researchers.
Maybe they're one of the same. Could be you the never same know. Thing. It's an autobiography. Yeah.
Researchers' best guesses have to do with a farmyard graveyard. That and that sounds like a band name, right?
Farmyard graveyard.
So we had the geometry of life and death and farmyard graveyard. I think that's good. Let's do it.
It's hot, dude.
It's hot. Out the kitchen. So this farmyard graveyard was discovered by some children who were playing in the hills in Griswold, Connecticut in 1990.
The hills are alive with vampires?
Yes.
All right.
Okay. 29. I don't really know how to respond to that.
That's fair.
29 bodies were discovered. And when they were, authorities were mortified. Basically, these kids like came home and they're like, "Mom, look, it's a skull." And she was like, "Oh no!" And they called the cops, and the cops are like, "Oh no!" As
I made a friend,
because they believed that this was the dumping ground of a notorious serial killer. Damn.
Dun dun dun.
Thank you. His name was Michael Ross. He had been operating in the area up until 1984, and they were convinced that these were some of his victims. However, pretty quickly, with great relief, it was determined that these were simply the family cemetery of the people who had farmed this area of land near the end of the 18th century.
Oh, good. These guys have been dead a lot longer.
Yes, yes. A very, very long time.
Whew.
Now, they had exhumed the bodies, and as they looked closer, though, they found something quite disturbing in grave number 4. Now, this coffin had been intentionally smashed. There were brass tacks that formed the letters JB on it, and when opened, they found that the body had been rearranged.
The so it head, sounds like with the brass tacks, this might have been a quick burial?
Yeah, yeah, that was their way of labeling who it was.
Yeah.
Now, they found that the head had been removed from the spine, and it was laid out in a Jolly Roger skull and crossbones kind of position. There were two thigh bones.
So wait, it's a pirate vampire?
Yes.
I'm so excited.
I know you are.
Under the torso then? Or like in like is the shin still below the Jolly Roger is what I'm curious about.
If I remember correctly, or if I'm visioning this correctly, you have at the top or even like near the middle, you have the skull with two femurs.
Right, right.
And then the rest of the bones are kind of just in a pile.
Oh.
Yeah. Disrespected.
So,
sad.
So the entire body then was disassembled and then just like stacked in there.
Mm-hmm. Because this took place.
Interesting.
As we'll see. Okay, so there's this state archaeologist. His name's Nick Bellatoni. He came in and examined it, and he determined that this took place 5 to 10 years after JB had been laid to rest.
Interesting.
He was resting for that time, and then he was decapitated and rearranged. So, go ahead.
Yeah, one vampire that I didn't actually talk about last week is the Germanic Shroud Eater, which is kind of interesting. So essentially, it's a vampire that eats the burial shroud and then in turn eats the rest of its body. And as it's doing that, it's actually like spiritually, not physically, going around and killing its family members and getting them sick, but it is also draining the life force out of his family members, which is pretty interesting because they also decapitate in order to stop the fiend from doing this. Also, what I thought was really interesting is that these Shroud Eaters are essentially, they come into being from folks that are typically dying of a disease.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought? Or have committed suicide or died in an accident.
Mm.
Which is like the...
So just
the,
unnatural deaths.
Well, I mean, accidental death is pretty natural. I mean, people
I mean,
do,
medically defined unnatural yes. death. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting to see that. And maybe that the idea that beheading, it, maybe that's what brought over to the new world as yeah. being what is the current way to get rid of a vampire.
Yeah. So Bellatoni is trying to figure out why. Why did this happen? Because we've been sitting here talking about vampires for an hour, but Bellatoni hadn't. He didn't know. This podcast didn't exist back then.
Poor Nick. If poor only Nick. He knew.
He had no idea. He comes up at first with the idea of grave robbing, which is probably like the most obvious and best first idea, but then it's very apparent there is no valuables anywhere in the entire premises. These are very poor farmers. There's absolutely no reason people would come and grave rob these people. He says, okay, maybe it's just vandalism for the sake of vandalism, but it just doesn't seem likely out of all of the different places that someone would hike. You're like 2 miles away from anything. Hike to this farm just to desecrate this one body for no apparent reason.
So unless you want to get away with it.
Well, that's true. Yeah, the more random a crime is, I'm sure the easier it is to get away with. But I don't know. Disclaimer, don't do crime. Bellatoni invited everyone interested to come take a look and try to figure out what exactly had happened to this man who was, like we said, referred to now as JB. Now, it wasn't until one of the graduate students in Bellatoni's research team asked if Bellatoni had ever heard the city or the story of what happened in Jewett City, which was 2 miles away from the site of JB's desecration, that the answer began to reveal itself. Half a century after JB was dug up and beheaded, a happening took place in Jewett City. Now, there was a family by the name of Ray who had suffered the devastating loss of their child Lemuel. He had been 24 and had wasted away before his family's eyes. Now, last week, Jason talked a little bit about tuberculosis, also known by the name consumption, especially in that time. But it's really important to understand the cultural significance of TB at the time. TB, if left untreated and a treatment didn't come out for it until 1946, has a 50% survival rate. Literally every other person who contracts it dies. And unfortunately, it could and very often would wipe out entire families or, as alluded to by the Serbian peasants, entire villages. Now, it was such a threat up through the 1950s that there were public campaigns advising mothers not to kiss their children because it would transmit the disease and kill them. There was like, what was it? There was like a poster I saw that said, like, your kiss of love is the germ's opportunity to enter from above. Terrible. That's awful. But it was such a problem even up until then. Right. Now, transmission occurs through the air. One single sneeze of an infected individual will release as many as 40,000 bacteria through the air, and you only have to ingest or inhale 10 of them for a perfectly well individual to become completely infected. If we're going to talk about pandemics, TB is the pandemic. And it was...
Yeah. Sounds like you've read way too much WebMD.
Yeah, like
that's terrifying.
It's really scary. The World Health Organization in like 1993 were like, we're gonna fight TB and we're gonna save all these people, and then like just they came back and looked like 25 years later, and it's like TB is still really kicking everyone's butt all over the world in developing mm-hmm. nations, especially in places like Africa where your rates of HIV and AIDS are so high. Because TB can be contracted and never show a symptom, or alternatively, it can be fought off. It has an infection rate of about 22%. But if you have something that lowers your immunodefense systems already, it's there.
It's gonna hit you hard.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. a pretty well like this is going to happen to you. Now, TB devours a previously healthy individual. During the course of the disease, it's not uncommon to lose half of a person's mass within weeks due to the disease, and the continual coughing up of blood as well as the constant fever was sure to put individuals into a frenzy of fear. Like, I guarantee you're hallucinating because of the fever. You're seeing yourself cough up blood. You're looking at yourself in the mirror, and you're a shadow of a
consumed.
Person.
Yeah.
You are being sucked out of this life. It is not surprising to be like, oh, yeah, some evil force is eating you, because that's exactly what it looked and felt like. Yeah, and especially when you then take it and say that, especially in the old world, that the people who did this were consumed, they were being consumed by vampires, you add that lore and that aspect of the boogeyman, and suddenly, yeah, you do see Peter throttling you at night, you know. Now, individuals with tuberculosis would become essentially modern-day lepers. They were either cast out of society or usually just confined to their home, unable to leave.
Which, I mean, that being said, too, like, people with deformities were frequently assumed to be vampires they died too.
Oh yeah.
So like that kind of scrutiny of, you know, someone that is different being a vampire is absolutely a huge character of lore behind them.
Yeah. Now, another aspect, we kind of mentioned this, another aspect can potentially be traced to TB, an aspect of the modern vampire, which, like Jason said, is the cross. The cross, the crucifix, when shown to a vampire, stops them in their track, and they have to...
Right.
So this idea, and it's not 100% proven, but I can see a pattern. I can see the line of rationalization here. This idea that religious iconography or rites can ward off vampirism may come from a common practice that was used to cure TB, which is the royal touch. Now, individuals who were affected by TB could and would often petition the royalty for a royal touch. The idea was that since kings and queens were divinely ordained and had the power of God flowing through them, their touch could cure all diseases.
Man, but, the good old days of empires.
Yeah.
And kingship.
But especially it was used for consumption, and granted, consumption wasn't always TB. It was really any sort of a wasting disease. Anything that confined a person to bed and caused them to lose weight would be consumption, but primarily it was tuberculosis that did that.
Yeah, that was the biggest one.
Mm-hmm. Now, a proper ceremony was constructed in many cultures where the monarch would announce the date and time of the touch. A line would form at that point, and then he would go through and touch all of them.
It's like the kissing booth.
Kind of.
Except you just poke them.
Yeah. What I don't understand is
how... Oh, you're sickly. Poke.
So many, like, they came into contact with so many sick people. Granted, this was before germ theory.
Right, but right.
I don't understand how the king did not just automatically die. So maybe...
Right?
Maybe there's something to it. In England, the monarch, after touching...
Probably poked him with a 10.5-foot pole.
No. It was an actual touch. It was a touch usually on the neck.
Mm-hmm.
And in England, after the touch, the monarch would present the afflicted individual with a golden coin called an angel. And it depicted the Archangel Michael slaying a dragon. Of course, symbolic for... Satan, Lucifer, right, being cast out of heaven and all of that.
Right, but I'm also thinking Dracula.
That's true as
being
well,
the son
yeah.
of the dragon or the son of the
there
devil.
There we go. That makes
that
sense.
There is a bit of connection there that I can see Bram have taken a leap with.
Exploiting, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, it's possible that this idea of the vampire being destroyed through contact with the divine has at least part of its roots in this ceremony. But this disease, which even in the modern day claims over 1 million people a year, is what gripped the Ray family of Jewett City in 1845. The first to waste away was 24-year-old Lemuel. Like we said, he was a son. 4 years later, the patriarch of the family, Henry B. Ray, wasted away before his family's eyes. Then 2 years later, a second son, Elisha, also passed away. While these tragic deaths set the scene over 6 years, they were simply the exposition to the panic that would follow 3 years after the death of Elisha, when the oldest and I believe only remaining son, Henry, who was named after his father, fell sick with the now tragically familiar symptoms. Now, it's important to remember that, like, when you originally come across these stories of people cutting out hearts and burning them and all this, it offends our sensibilities. It makes us think, oh, what savages. Oh, they're...
Yeah, it's not... Well, it makes me think of the early 2000s movie Van Helsing, where, yes, you know, you have pitchforks and torches. What a freaking
movie, man.
Dude, I loved that movie.
It was good.
Oh, man. But you don't have, like, the mob of angry villagers going off to the cemetery to just dig up and exhume everyone and burn them all. It was more of a terror.
Yes.
You know, it was more of a fearful display of human, like, this is the last thing I can do. This is the only thing we can do.
And more, and on that as well, beyond the fear, it was also motivated by a love not only of the living, but a love of the dead. You're essentially told through folklore and through these rituals that if you truly love your dead child, you will dig them up, cut off their head, burn them, because it will free them.
Becoming a vampire or a zombie-esque individual, that is the worst thing that could happen to a deceased relative.
Exactly. And that's what they did. They disinterred Elisha and Lemuel. They didn't disinter the father, Henry.
I can't imagine exhuming a dead relative, though.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk.
No, thank you.
We'll talk a minute more about it with Mercy Brown, but they...
Lord have mercy.
I hope he does. The family...
Foreshadowing.
...disinters Elisha and Lemuel. They cut off the heads, they rearrange it into skull and crossbones. And so the idea is that somehow or another, it's not sure exactly how, but this event in Jewett City was influenced by the event at this farm 2 miles previous, 50 years ago.
Yeah, it could be that, you know, JB's case is just undocumented.
Right.
You know, or it was documented, but that was lost to time in some sort.
You're right. It's something that the community knew about, talked about, and therefore when it happened to the Ray family, they said, okay, we already had a way to do it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, the other bookend of the great New England vampire panic would come out just about 100 years after JB's exhumation, Let me try this again. The other bookend of the great New England vampire panic would come out just before 100 years after JB's exhumation and desecration. Now, between these two cases, there were events that have been totaled over 80, or there have been over 80 events that have been totaled and examined so far by the folklorist Michael E. Bell. He has no doubts that there are hundreds more awaiting discovery, because we like to think about this as a backwards, turned-around idea about the world, something that happened few and far between, but he truly believes that this was a very, very common practice. And there's even an account, we didn't talk about it on this episode, I just didn't have time to research it, but there is one account of this happening with a wealthy upper class family as well. Like a guy who like went to Yale and all of that, his son got sick and he eventually said, let's do it. You know, we have no other option. So it's not even just the poor. The newspapers at the time certainly made it seem that way. And they made fun of these poor people and all of that, but it was happening all over and all the time. Now I said it last week, but I want to repeat this quote for this account. It's said by the great-grandnephew of the last vampire exhumed in America in 1892, Mercy Brown, and said by her great-grandnephew, Everett Peck, who is being interviewed by Michael E. Bell for his fantastic book, Food for the Dead, which is a great... I used it for a lot of the research in this. It's a great book if you're ever looking for more information about this from like a folkloric perspective. Now, the book says, quote, "Do I believe?" Everett asked rhetorically. "I believe my mother. I believe the family did what they did. Do I believe in vampire?" he repeated, adding the crucial word. "No, no, I don't believe in that. I'm not sure they did, but they had to come for an answer. And it turned out that maybe that was the answer. And some of these old people probably died with that in their mind, that they did the right thing." Now, the story of Mercy Brown is one of the most tragic, in my opinion, of all the ones we covered today. The Brown family, led by George and Mary, lived in Exeter, Rhode Island. There were five of them. There was George and Mary, husband and wife, and then there was the son, Edwin, and two daughters, the older, Mary Olive, and the younger, Mercy Lena. Now, in 1882, Mary, the mother, passed away due to, of course, consumption. The following year, Mary Olive, The following year, Mary Olive was also killed by TB when she was just 20 years old. The once full and happy family was reduced down to just George's father, Mercy's daughter, and Edwin his son. And while a shadow had been cast over the family home, they did their best for the next few years to hold on and get by. But then in 1890, Edwin also contracted the disease. On doctor's orders, he was sent to Colorado Springs, where the air was better due to the dry climate, to recover. And he would eventually return. However, as he was gone, Mercy fell ill. Mercy fell ill in January of 1982. Hers was the kind of TB referred to as the galloping kind, which means that it was dormant in her system probably for many years, maybe even from the original time when her mother was sick. But when it activated, when it became, active, whatever.
Yeah, it was very explosive, very quick.
Yes, she was dead in a matter of days.
Yikes.
Yeah. Now, upon Edwin's return, it was found that while he had improved a little, he was still very, very sick and very much in danger of being consumed. As time went on, the townspeople began to come to George Brown, once a loving husband and a father of three in his big empty house. They told him that there was something that could be done. He didn't have to sit by and watch his last remaining family member die as he had his wife and daughters. And this is that moment where you have to try to put yourself in that position, and you have to try to imagine what this person is going through when they say to him, "We can save your son, but we have to dig up your wife and your daughters, and we have to cut the heart out of one of them." And it's just like, how do you even possibly cope with that? How do you deal with that? But as time went on and Edwin got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, he finally said, okay, all right, let's do it. He mm-hmm. didn't go, for sure. He stayed home, rightfully so. They dig up Mary and Mary Olive. They've been in the ground for many years. They're properly decayed, not vampires here. We're good. Now, Mercy, though, she had died relatively shortly before this in the winter. The ground still had not thawed, and so she was stored in an above-ground crypt, basically, that was basically a freezer, is what it was at the end of the day. Because of this, of course, her body was extremely well-preserved. They found, again, that her nails had fallen off and new ones had grown. Her skin was showing. Like, basically, the skin would crack, and then they'd see under the skin, but they thought that was more better skin that was growing, essentially. And they said, oh my gosh, she really looks like she's still alive. So they cut out her heart, and they find that it is full of blood and obviously still alive in their beliefs. Mm-hmm. And they burn it on a rock that is close by. They take the ashes of the heart and they mix it with water and they feed it to Edwin, and George Brown waits and waits and waits. But as time goes on, of course, Edwin gets only worse until 2 months later when he too dies, leaving George Brown alone. And not much is known what happened to him after that, but the news of Mercy Brown spread like wildfire throughout the world, going on to possibly influence Bram Stoker. Some people say that because of the time that the story was published and then when Dracula was being written, it couldn't have
the overlap.
Yeah, it couldn't have done. But again, Mercy's full name was Mercy Lena, or Lena Mercy, and the girl who's afflicted by Dracula is named Lucy. And some people see that as like an amalgamation of Lena and Mercy. So it's possible.
Darn people finding patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. But it definitely influenced H.P. Lovecraft, who in his weird ways wrote a story about a man trapped in a house that was haunted by his relatives, one of which was Mercy, named Mercy after Mercy Brown. So,
interesting.
That's the vampire panic. That's New England. That's the tragic like just heavy crap you had to deal with when you were settling the new world. It was just, and even after settling it, even as we got into the later centuries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, settling it was rough. It was like a 1 in 3 chance that you would not survive your first winter.
Yeah.
For most of the settlers that came over in like the Mayflower and, are like Jamestown as yeah. well. Like it was, you did not last very long in the new world, but at this point in time, you know, you
better,
had established but, communities. Yeah. It was a lot better,
but even but then, still,
like, yeah, you, death is a common thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Now I did say though, last week that there were stories that I had for you that were easily explained, which were the last 4 stories. And then there's one or two here that depending on how much you want to believe,
none of it
give you something to believe.
Okay.
So the biggest, scariest one and most supernatural, it focuses on the Churchill Tunnel in Richmond, Virginia, which was a tunnel that was opened in 1875. However, in Virginia, the soil has a very, very high clay composition, mm-hmm. which caused frequent collapses and cave-ins.
Oh, yeah, it's way too fine.
Mm-hmm. Finally, the CNO railway finally condemned the tunnel, turned their transportation needs elsewhere. However, in 1925, officials decided, okay, we're going to try to get this back up and running. We're going to use this tunnel. But it did collapse one last time, this time trapping a work train full of people. Multiple individuals died and disappeared, but there was an explosion that happened that cleared some of the rubble just a little bit. And when it did, something came out of the cave-in, something that it was said that the skin was hanging off of its face and its arms. It had sharp, jagged teeth, and it supposedly jumped into the nearby James River, then made its way pursued by a mob. This is like in Van Helsing, where they are pursuing things as a mob, pursued into the nearby Hollywood Cemetery, where it vanished into the mausoleum of a W.W. Poole. Now, in life, Poole was a bookkeeper, but there were 2 strange things about his grave, and this at least is true. His grave, he died in 1922, but his grave was marked as his death being in 1913. And there was no birth date or even birth year on the grave. There was just the death date. People look at this as a way of saying, well,
something
maybe
fishy might have been going
something
on.
Was going on. Yeah. And if we think about it, right. So if he died in 1922,
probably tax evasion.
It could be. He
tax
was a bookkeeper
or life insurance, man.
If he died in 1922, it is, I suppose, theoretically possible that he wasn't actually dead and that he like survived somehow. I don't know how exactly. And then he was in the tunnel for some reason, came out, went and hid in his own grave. In any case, he was eventually dead because they had to move his body because people kept trying to vandalize it because they thought he was a vampire.
Makes sense.
Look, bizarre. So that's the Richmond Vampire. That one is very well known, very famous in its home area. It could be completely explainable. It could be something else. It sounds very strange.
Sounds very tall tale.
Yes. Lore did an episode on it, and it was one of his earlier episodes. I'm not the like I have nothing against Aaron Mankey. I'm just not the biggest fan of Lore's later stuff, but the earlier stuff is really, really good. So go listen to that. I don't know which one it is. Good luck on finding it. but the last story, it's a little less supernatural, but it's still definitely difficult to fully explain. And it has to do with New Orleans. Okay, so New Orleans has been a place of hauntings and the supernatural and the twisted and the bizarre, and you have voodoo and the rougarou and werewolves and vampires and swamps, everything that this show is about.
It's like one of the few American cities that feel like it's still very deeply rooted in culture when we think about it.
Yeah.
And that culture where the veil between the living and the dead is very thin.
Mm-hmm. There are a few different vampires supposedly kicking around in New Orleans, one of whom is the Comte de Saint-Germain, which is an individual who, according to like court documents back in the 18th century, supposedly in the 18th century was already like 150 years old and then migrated to America and lived in New Orleans and is still seen from time to time, supposedly. Mm-hmm. He's very fascinating. Astonishing Legends did like a 3-part series on him, so everyone should go listen to that. But what we want to look at here is a pair of brothers, the brothers Carter, John and Wayne.
Now, wait. John and Wayne.
Carter. Yes. John Carter and Wayne Carter, not John Wayne Carter.
Okay.
They are real people. These people do exist. Okay. I promise. Now they made their way to New Orleans in the midst of the Great Depression. And according to everyone who knew them, by the way, content warning, as has been for this entire episode, retroactively content warning.
Now that you heard it,
you can't sue me. They made their way to New Orleans in the midst of the Great Depression. And according to everyone who knew them, they were lovely, respectable young men, very polite, very thoughtful, hardworking, industrious, and easy on the eyes. The young men were a delight to have around, which is why it shocked everyone when one day before they got home from work, a young woman covered in blood escaped from their apartment, alerting the police that she and four other individuals, male and female, had been captured by the men and held there to feed.
Ooh.
They had been told by the men that they were vampires, not the victims, the men were vampires. The brothers were vampires, and that they would be kept alive for as long as the brothers wanted and then discarded when the time came. When the police raided the house, they found this grisly tale to be true, complete with more than a dozen, I think it was like 13 or 14 other dead bodies drained completely of blood hidden throughout the home. Mm-hmm. And then four more survivors. Now, when the Carters returned home from work, it took 8 police officers to subdue the 2 men. And when the officers were talking about it later in the reports, they said that it just seemed they just had an unnatural strength about them. However, they were eventually subdued, then they were tried, then they were executed. Now, in New Orleans, because of the way the soil is and all of that, it's a common thing to have these vaulted graves where essentially they go down deep into the earth. You open the vault, you put in a body. A few years later, you open the vault, you put in a body, and they just kind of sink over time. Now, this is how...
What do you mean by sink? Like the bodies or like the actual vaults?
The bodies sink and create more room for more bodies up top.
So they decompose.
As they go down. Yes, they decompose down into the earth. That's
right.
As opposed to decomposing in a box.
Right. So you just, it's like a normal catacomb.
Sure, yes.
That. Where you put them essentially on a shelf.
Yeah, but then the shelf pushes down. They're stacked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think I'm following.
Okay. Anyway, the main point of it is that when you open the vault to put in somebody else, you see the last person that was in there. Okay. When they opened the vault after the Carter brothers were executed, the Carter brothers were not in there. The grave, the person in the grave, I don't know who it was before, but it was the person who was in there before the Carter brothers had been interred. Okay. So the other thing about it, okay, first off, people say that they see the Carter brothers still. I don't know how they know because there's no photographs of these people, but perfect. They say that they see
them.
But one interesting component as well is the legacy of these brothers. They had supposedly told their victims that in order to become a vampire, one would be fed on for 7 days in a row. If you're fed on for 7 days in a row, you become a vampire. One of the survivors of the Carter brothers was a man named Philippe. Philippe had been used as feed by the brothers for over a week. So he had passed the 7-day line, supposedly. And granted, I wasn't able to find a whole lot. And the main reason why is because when you Google Philippe vampire, there is like a series of books in which a vampire's main, like the main vampire's name is Philippe.
Perfect.
And so it is almost impossible to find any actual things. But supposedly this man, after he was rescued, he went on to become a serial killer as well, killing 32 people and draining them of blood as well. So that's the legacy. So those two, right? The Richmond vampire, who knows? There is a lot of talk that it was just some poor individual who was trapped in the tunnel, whose skin got burned off by an explosion, and then ran
to the river. Makes sense because, well, your body's on fire.
On fire. So there's that. The Carter brothers is interesting, to say the least. The idea that the bodies aren't there, not saying that they rose again from the grave, but somebody could have taken them.
Yeah,
and stolen them away.
And I mean, it's great to see that, because it is such a post Stoker vampire style.
Yes, it is the vampire in the new world, exactly like we want. They're drinking blood. They're rising attractive. From the dead. They're attractive. Mm-hmm. They're well mannered and genteel and polite.
Right.
And they talk like this. No, they don't. But
and previously, becoming a vampire was dying of disease.
Yes.
You know, now it's being, you know, your blood being drank for 7 days in a row, which is not something that I don't think I've ever heard before as far as a transformation requirement.
Me neither. But it sounds like it's just simply lore. Who knows where the brothers found it, but the brothers had found that lore somewhere and passed it on. Mm-hmm. Just like how lore just pops up and sometimes people take it
right.
And sometimes they throw it away. But
and as far as like explaining this kind of stuff away, it could be a bit of the placebo effect as far as the brothers go. I mean, they have to be strong enough to, of course, subdue numerous people by themselves anyway.
Right.
So they could just be incredibly good at that in order to fight off most of the officers.
Right.
And secondly, I mean, as far as Felipe goes, he could have been brainwashed by them and to some extent to believing that he was a vampire and believing that he had all
and
these
then
needs
gone forward.
Now. And because, I mean, again, I talked about it last week, but a human, as soon as you drink a liter of blood, bad things start happening to you.
Yeah.
So it's very, very hard for anyone to be sustained off of blood. Now, they would have to supplement it with a normal diet, of course, which is what you see in a lot of current vampire culture of people that do drink blood that's given by donors.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. Those people do, again, believe that it is more of a supernatural essence to it that makes them have some sort of heightened ability or better at certain things because it's... Yeah, it's the idea, it's the belief in it that makes it happen.
Yes, yes. The believing it makes it so, yes. And that's why when Bell, in his book, writes about vampires, he just calls them vampires. He obviously does not believe in blood-sucking spirits of any kind, but he says, just for linguistic sake, I am not going to sit here and type the people that people called vampires, especially because in the minds of the people, these vampires existed. They were there.
Right.
They were vampires. And it's the
physical force.
It's kind of like Werner Herzog, who I'm going to try to find a way to work into every single episode from here on out. He talks about how when you're telling a story, the story is not complete until it is viewed, until it is seen by the viewer, who then, at the end of the process, decides what the story means and what is truth within the story itself.
That's fair. That's a very artistic way of digesting, a process of a piece of work, of an art,
Yes.
That's I mean, it's most art is now crafted in order to get some sort of emotional response out of someone. And that's how you speak more depth to people.
Right.
I just totally derailed it, didn't I?
Yeah, totally. But that's okay. Sorry. So it is in that same kind of vein that I looked at this and I was doing this research, and I agree with that in general, especially when it comes to like cinema and stuff like that. But I think it rings potent in this story. These people are vampires. Now, who can say what a vampire actually is? But these people, not the Carter brothers, maybe the Carter brothers, but Mercy Brown, the Ray family, the Serbian peasants, they are vampires one way or the other, even if it's just in the mind of the public. So it was interesting. It was an interesting research. It was interesting to see that development for myself. But man, am I happy that we're not talking about vampires from here on out for
ever.
What? Not forever. Like, if somebody has a good vampire story, ooh, please let me know. But it'll, it's good. It's good. So, yeah. Cool.
Those are your tales you got for us?
Those are my tales of Vampiria from the homeland of Transylvania. Don't go see Hotel Transylvania 3. Anyway, yes. No, we're good. So, yeah, that's what I've got. And I actually think... I mean, we're at an hour and a half. It's going to come down to an hour probably after editing, but I think it was good.
Solid.
I don't think that was terrible. I thought it was going to be terrible.
I enjoyed our time here.
Thanks, buddy. Anything else you want to say?
Nah, man. That about sums it all up.
Okay. All right. So, cool. Yeah, that about sums it up for me as well. Guys, thanks for listening. We love you. We appreciate you. We want to thank, really quick, we got one new iTunes review. We want to thank Polk1816. I don't know if that means James K. Polk. I can't remember when he was president, but I dig it. he says, or they say, sorry, not to assume, delightful, 5 stars. Hey, I'm writing this while listening to the vampire episode. CZ is pronounced ch and SZ is pronounced sh. So... there you go. Now we know.
Great to know. I'm sorry. I won't remember that.
Yeah, it's over. But thank you for that review. That's very kind of you. And then we got, yeah, I think we just got one new patron. That's good. So we would like to thank Megan Dameron.
Woo, yeah, Megan.
Thank you so much. And if anybody wants to know how to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. You can get early access to episodes, uncut episodes. One day, maybe, again, we will do bonus episodes when we have time. We'll see. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to you like what we do, we like doing what we do, and you want to keep it going. So for all of our patrons, we're so grateful for you. We love the heck out of you. So, beyond that, guys, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Not Alone Pod. You can find us on Facebook, Not Alone Podcast. You can find our Facebook group, Remember We Are Not Alone, a community for the strange. You can find us on Instagram. I forgot to post last week's episode to Instagram, and I kind of feel bad, but I kind of don't care. So whatever. And you can find Jason at Mighty Moit on Twitter. So Mighty Moit. Yeah.
Yeah, that sums it about up.
Cool.
Yeah, dude.
Remember, whether you lay just below the surface, waiting for night to fall, so you can gorge yourself on the blood of the innocent, or you are sitting behind a locked door, stake in hand, you are not alone. 'Cause there are vampires.